From the studios of Wavefront Audio Visual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 115 of Little Brother for the 21st of January, 2023. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants, and that's not just me this week, and not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can write me at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com, or you can post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. We got a long one this week, so let's get started. I've spoken a few times about the right to repair. In fact, I spoke about it just two episodes ago in 113, and it'll be touched on briefly in the interview later in this episode. Between then and now, John Deere have signed a Memorandum of Understanding with the Farm Bureau in an attempt to stop being the poster boy for the right to repair movement. The good news is obvious. Farmers who have previously found themselves at John Deere's mercy are no longer at their mercy. Unfortunately, the Memorandum of Understanding is not legally binding, and Deere can just walk away from the agreement at any time. The worst part, however, is that in exchange for this, Deere have gotten the Farm Bureau to agree to stop advocating and lobbying for right-to-repair laws, meaning that the movement has lost its best and most powerful ally. The French Data Protection Authority, Le Commission Nationale de l'Informatique et de Liberté, which translates as the National Commission on Informatics and Freedoms, CNIL for short, has levied a fine against Apple for 8 million euro, or approximately 8.66 million US dollars at the time of this recording, for privacy violations. I can hear the reaction now. Apple? Vous n'êtes pas sérieux. Yes, I am serious. It appears that Apple, for all of their talk of privacy protections for their users, have been, well, spying on their users to target ads. As usual, there's probably no nefarious intent here. They just want to sell stuff. But that does not mean that it is not harmful. Here in the US, there are many parts of the country where broadband access is sketchy, and some where it's just flat out not available at all. Meanwhile, on the other side of the pond, the UK have just amended their building regulations to state that new residential buildings, get this, new residential buildings must be built with gigabit broadband connections. How cool is that? Well, here is a possible use for all of that bandwidth. I've mentioned before Israeli spyware company Cellebrite. They provide tools that can be used by law enforcement and other authorities to crowbar data out of locked cell phones and similar devices. There's another company in the same business, MSAB, based out of Sweden. Well, Distributed Denial of Secrets has acquired and published a leak on each of these two companies, totaling about 1.8 terabytes of content, consisting of the software and documentation. Torrent links may be found on the DDO Secrets website. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. Well, here we are again. It's time for another round of Who Got Pwned in the Last 2 Weeks. It has been a busy fortnight. We've got 4 of them for you. First up, we have the Royal Mail. It appears as though the Royal Mail, the National Postal Service of the United Kingdom, was a victim of a ransomware attack at the hands of the Lockbit Gang. According to the BBC's reporting on the topic, the affected systems are those that are used to dispatch deliveries abroad. From the appearance of it, postal service within the country was not impacted. However, it's easy as an American to lose sight of the relatively short distance that that covers. The Royal Mail briefly asked British citizens and companies not to send any mail abroad while they get this problem sorted. Meta, the parent company of Facebook, Instagram, and others, have filed a lawsuit against Voyager Labs, asking a judge to permanently ban the surveillance company from accessing Meta's sites. This comes after Voyager used numerous fake accounts on Meta's sites to harvest the data of approximately 600,000 users. An investigation carried out by The Guardian revealed that the Los Angeles Police Department were amongst Voyager's customers. MailChimp, a mass email provider, comes next. MailChimp employees were socially engineered into providing their credentials to an attacker. The company is stating that only 133 customers were impacted and that they are working with those customers to remedy the situation. Last up, T-Mobile got pwned. Wait, haven't I said that before? Why, yes. Yes, I have. Episodes 48, 66, and 83, along with many following episodes with commentaries and follow-ups to those. Well, they've been pwned again. That's 4 pwns in the 19 months that this podcast has been running, which gives us an average of just under 5 months between pwns. Having been a T-Mobile customer until just recently, I do have one suggestion. Maybe take security a little seriously. You could start by allowing better account credentials than just an 8-digit all-numeric PIN. Alright, so I'm here with DOA, and DOA has come to talk to us about a project called Project Lifesaver. But before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about why Project Lifesaver is important. So, DOA, first of all, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you could start by telling me a little bit about your son and about his situation as much as you feel comfortable sharing with me.
Sure. So, my son is 11. And he was diagnosed very early on with autism. He's on the ASD spectrum. He is nonverbal. Like many on the spectrum, he tends to have a lesser sense of danger and safety, which is very common with people on the spectrum. Along with being nonverbal, it makes things a little difficult beyond just learning disabilities.
Okay.
So, obviously, keeping an eye on him is a lot more important than, say, a typically developing adolescent or child. So, that's pretty much where he comes in. I'm sure most people that are listening have had some sort of third-party experience with someone with autism sometime in their life, or somebody with some sort of disability in that area. Probably don't need to get into a lot of detail about that, other than that he is active, you know, and all the other things that come with autism. Sure.
So tell me a little bit about Project Lifesaver. What is that?
Project Lifesaver is a program. I'm not sure if it's nationally, federally, or just within New York State. I'm not sure about that. But essentially, it is a project that provides a transmitter about the size of a typical wristwatch, a little thicker, that transmits a frequency in the 216 megahertz range for people with dementia on the ASD spectrum, etc. What happens is if someone with Project Lifesaver on the spectrum, dementia, etc., becomes lost, gets away from their caregiver, etc., that caregiver can call the organizing entity. In many cases, or I think in all cases in New York State, it's the county sheriff's department, and say, my son has Project Lifesaver. If you have the frequency, it does help. It cuts down on time there from them looking it up. My son has Project Lifesaver, transponder with frequency, XYZ. He has been gone approximately 5 minutes or whatever that time is. He is X number of years old, and I can't find him. Okay. He has gotten away. And the timing and age is because the sheriff's departments, police departments, etc., have tables and data that say a child of, say, 10 years old can move an average of X number of feet or miles in X number of minutes. So then they at least have a general idea how far they could have gotten if they were determined to. From there, I think some fire departments have receivers in their vehicles. Law enforcement has receivers in their vehicles. And from my research and understanding, within the vehicles, for anybody that has some background in RF, whether ham radio or commercial radio, are more omnidirectional antennas. They can get somebody within about 2 miles. So then they know they're within about 2 miles. From there, then they park, they get out of their vehicle, and they have a directional antenna connected to a receiver, a handheld one, and then they literally can walk in the direction to find the, for lack of a better term, patient. I believe a few years ago, maybe around 2015, 2014, somewhere around there, I think late teens, early 20s, someone on the spectrum, I believe down around Binghamton, where they found him in a matter of hours. Statistically, it's said that people with Project Lifesaver, it cuts down search times from weeks or days down to hours or minutes sometimes, because that there's actually something connected to them. So that's the basics of what it is. For anybody that's a ham that may be listening, it's very similar to amateur radio game Fox and Hound.
It's very much like
it's
Fox and Hound. Yeah.
It's essentially the same thing, except the fox is moving. I mean, let's be honest, like, that's really what it is. So as a ham myself, once I heard that was how it was operating off RF and how it was working, I found that very ironic that something that has been done in ham radio for 40, 50, maybe 60 years is actually has a safety aspect to it and is being utilized for public safety, even if that public group is a very limited subset of the overall population.
That's good stuff. I don't know whether or not you want to get into whether or not you have had to use it with your son.
Almost. We almost had to. We originally got it in a different county.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had moved to get him into the area's special education program through BOCES, which is known by many to be one of the best special education autism programs in the region. So we moved to a different county, different town, roughly about 15, 20 minutes, not a super long move. And while moving in, we had moved into an apartment temporarily. I was working because, you know, that's what most of us have to do. And the cable technician came to drop internet to our apartment because I work in IT. So guess what? Need internet. It's just one of those things. So he had been going in and out, in and out, and he had left the door open. At the time, our son was about 5, I'm thinking, 4 or 5 years old, something like that. And he went right out the door onto the street. And by the time my wife, who is very, very on the ball about where he is, to also show you how fast he is, ran outside, off the deck, to the road, across the road, which we were one house in from an intersection, to the next house and around the corner out of sight. Needless to say, my wife lost her shit. Understandably, as she's running out, she messages me and tells me what's happening. And of course, I'm in Albany, and so a decent drive away for anybody that knows actually who I am and where we are located.
That's probably, what, 75 minutes or so?
Probably close to it, maybe slightly less, yeah. So I was way too far away to do anything, and end of story. So she goes, has her phone in her hand, runs out of the house as she's dialing the local sheriff's department, and finds him on the other side of the road, past the corner of visibility from the house across the street, sitting in the grass and just playing.
Ooh.
So, well, we don't know any of our neighbors. We'd been in the apartment a couple days. That's it. Time Warner was there dropping internet. So, I mean, we literally had just moved in. Like, this must have been a Monday or a Tuesday, and we moved in that weekend. So, yeah, she was losing it. She saw him, so she didn't have to call the sheriff's department, but it was very, very close call there. And the big thing is, as I mentioned before, he's nonverbal. So even if somebody found him, he couldn't tell anybody his name or anything like that. So that was a scary moment for about 5 to 10 minutes.
I can only imagine it was.
Obviously, any good or decent parent is always going to worry about their child. But then when you add on anything from a learning disability, autism, anywhere on the autism spectrum, or anything else, it just compounds that protectiveness. So, yeah, that was the only time that we almost had to use it. Actually, my wife literally had the sheriff's department number in her phone ready to hit dial when she found him.
Wow.
I mean, he was only, I don't know, 75 feet from the house. He wasn't far. It was just visibility.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so from your firsthand experience, you don't know, you haven't had the chance to use it, you don't really know how effective it is, but the fact that they're leaning into it kind of suggests that
it's worth doing.
Yes, and when we first got it back in, it would have been 2014, I believe, there was only a couple counties in the state that actually had some part of Project Lifesaver active. Now I think a large number of states or counties within New York State, let's see, what is there, 62, 63 counties?
62.
I want to say there's probably upwards of 45, 50, I'm guessing, that actually have Project Lifesaver now in some form or another. So that's a great thing. I think it's great. I think there's definitely benefits to Project Lifesaver and the way they use technology for this purpose over others, but I think there's also shortcomings. The RF, I think, is better for if somebody is in heavy cloud cover, dense foliage, GPS is not going to work as well.
Fog?
Possibly even fog, because GPS will not work as well as both you and I know.
Oh, I see what you're getting at.
You know, it's not going to hit a satellite. But one of the negatives of it is, being it's RF and such a low power output, if you're too far away, say an abduction, somebody gets in a car, they can easily go miles, and then it's going to be extremely hard to locate that individual.
Sure.
While GPS would be a benefit in those situations. So I think there's definitely a trade-off. If somebody or an entity, organization could combine the two, I think that would be very invaluable, because it would give the benefits of both types of technology, GPS and RF, while mitigating and negating the cons and downsides of the respective technologies.
So I understand you've had a little bit of a problem with batteries.
Yes, a little bit. This has happened a couple times, because batteries have to be changed roughly every 60 days. And they are quote unquote not user replaceable. They're not considered a user replaceable or user maintainable part. for anybody that isn't familiar with Project Lifesaver, which hopefully is most, let's be honest, it's, as I said, it's about the size of a watch battery. It is thicker. It's probably about 3/4 of an inch to an inch thick. Yeah, it's
the
probably...
battery itself?
No, the case. Oh, the case, yes. Okay. Yeah, yeah. And in order to replace the battery, you have to remove the band, which once it's on, the only way to get it off is to cut it.
Oh.
Yes, because obviously you don't want somebody to just take it off. Like, my son likes scissors, so it has... We keep a few extra wristbands because he has cut them off in the past. Ironically, he has looked me right in the eyes with scissors and snipped them as he looks at me in the eyes. It's, the first time was funny. The second time was not. And when I mean the second time, I mean the second time in about 15 minutes. But you take that off, you take the band off, and there is a screw back to it that you have to unscrew.
Mm-hmm.
It requires a custom key, not a key like a house key, but just the way, think of it like almost like a key like to take some watch batteries off, like back of watches off.
Is it like a security screwdriver?
Not like a screwdriver. It's got like 3 or 4 little posts. Whether it's every 90 degrees, every 120 degrees, whatever it is, depending on how many prongs there are to it. You have to put it on the back, line it up, and then you turn it. But you can't use a screwdriver. You can't use... Because the prongs or indentations are on the outside of the screw back.
Okay.
So, because it's not user-replaceable or maintainable, you have to take it to the sheriff's department, which have that key. Now, once you unscrew it, there's gel and stuff because these cases, when properly maintained, are waterproof. So baths, showers, pools, oceans, swimming, none of that makes a difference. So there's also an O-ring in there, etc. But when you pull it off, clean it all up nice, the actual circuit board is very small. The battery is essentially the same. I'm not sure if the part number is the same. It's probably different, but essentially it's just like a watch battery. What are those, like CR3202s or whatever?
That's what I pictured when you first described it to me.
Yes. Yeah, that I don't think it's that actual battery. I think it's a different actual part number, but essentially the same size.
Well, I know there's a couple of different sizes of CRs.
But it's about the same as the 3202s or whatever they are, about the same size. So they go, they clean it up, they pull out the battery, they put a new one in. If the O-ring looks weathered, they'll replace the O-ring. If not, they'll just put some more gel around it, put on the back, tighten it up nice and tight. And then they have a small tester, maybe about the size of a pack of gum or so, that they just place over the Project Lifesaver transmitter, and it will blink about once every second and a half.
Okay.
And as long as it blinks, it's good to go. And then they'll go put a new band on it, put it on the patient's wrist, make sure it's the right size so it's not too tight, not too loose, etc. And then off you go for about 60 days. Now, two times. First time was last year, mid-year, which was the worst of the two situations in my eyes, because I was out of town. I was out of state. I was down in Texas for work.
Okay.
So for about a week. And I think it was, I flew out on Monday, flew back on Friday, and I think it was late Monday. My wife texts me and says, oh, son's Project Lifesaver battery died. Because we also have a tester. We test it every morning.
Okay.
And so maybe it was in the morning that she messaged me. No, it must have been Tuesday because we sent him to school. Everything was fine on Monday. So it was Tuesday must be, she said that. And it took, I think, till the beginning of the following week when I got back. Or the end of the week I was gone when I was coming back. I can't remember at this point. Where they finally got somebody in the office to connect with my wife and say, bring him over, we will change the battery. And then this just also happened, what was it when I mentioned to you, like a week ago or 2 weeks ago, that the second time happened recently?
Yeah, maybe in the past 2 weeks.
Yeah, and that's what obviously kicked off this interview for this podcast.
Right, exactly.
So, actually, I think it was...
Last week.
Yeah, because that's when you talked about Right to Repair on your podcast. So it was like a couple days, it was probably Monday or Tuesday, because I usually listen to the podcast on Monday. So that was the second time, and it took probably 4 or 5 days to get somebody to be in the office. My wife called every day after the test failed, meaning the battery had died.
Yeah.
And first time she called, whoever picked up, I'm not sure if it was just somebody in the office or if it was 911 dispatch on the not emergency line, because for our county, the sheriff's department literally has an access door into the 911 dispatch office. So I don't know who picked up, but would transfer her to the person responsible for Project Lifesaver. And she got voicemail like 3 days in a row. I get it if somebody's not in the office, if they're a deputy or investigator, they're out doing their job. Cool, they're doing their job. Like, that's why we pay people.
Of course.
But 3 days? 72 hours? No. No, that's not good for 72
hours with not so much as a response to the voice.
Correct. Correct. And she called back the next day. So after 24 hours, called back again the next day until she got somebody. She kept leaving voicemails until she got somebody. To me, for something that, even though she called the non-emergency line, like many things, it's not an emergency until it is an emergency. Let's be honest, we're all adults, I'm sure, that are listening to the podcast. It's not a problem if my son's Project Lifesaver battery gets changed a day or two later. It is a problem if he goes missing, because that is a lawsuit on negligence at that point. Because you don't tell me somebody is not manning that voicemail box.
Right.
If my son goes missing, he becomes abducted, something like that, that is a large lawsuit. I think we can all agree negligence cases get taken very seriously in court, and they usually have high payouts. And if something happens to my son, as I'm sure anybody else would, they will go after said department for everything they have, because family is the most important thing.
Yes, it is.
Let me preface by saying, I don't mean this as a threat to any law enforcement office. It's a serious thing.
For the sake of the argument, that it wasn't you, it's still the same situation.
Yes.
It's still the same possibility that somebody's loved one could go missing.
Exactly.
Findable because of the fact that nobody ever answered the voicemail to get their damn battery changed.
Yes. And I understand, and I know this is all having to do with the whole right to repair issue. And granted, not everybody is going to be able to have the technical knowledge, although it's not a super technical thing, to be able to do this in their home. But it should be an option. And even if you have to go in for a 1 hour training, if you want to do it, fine. I even told the last deputy that was in charge of this, she was wonderful. She went to a different police department in the area. So nothing against her. But I even said, I would volunteer my time when I'm not at work. If I could get the training, I would come in and help the sheriff's department as a secondary contact for Project Lifesaver. Give me the training. If it takes an hour, it takes 15 minutes to do the training. It's not, if you can change a watch battery or hook up a TV in your living room, it's not much more technical than that.
And that's kind of one of the things that I was thinking. So, for those listening who would not have seen what I have just done, I've just reached into my backpack and pulled out and laid on the table in front of me a ham radio handheld transceiver, HT as we call them. And the reason I pulled this out is because of the fact that the model that I have here is a Yaesu FT270, which is a fully waterproof two-way radio. It has got rubber seals all over the place. When you hold it in your hand, you feel like you're holding on to something solid. You shake it, nothing rattles. When you open the battery compartment, that's the sound of the battery compartment opening. When you open the battery compartment, you find that there are rubber O-rings everywhere, and that everything inside the battery compartment, except for the two contacts that interface to the battery itself, are all sealed, waterproof, and safe. So my question is, if they can do something like that for something as fundamentally unimportant, okay, yes, I know as a ham, something like this is important to you and to I, but for something that is as fundamentally unimportant as a hobby device can be made waterproof with a removable battery, for what reason could this not be done under a right to repair guise for a incredibly, incredibly, critically important device such as a Project Lifesaver transponder?
I totally agree, and I understand there are some things that would restrict home charging, say wireless charging, things like that, because you can't have something like a wristband, like say on a smartwatch, where you can take it off,
sure,
throw it on. Obviously, that goes without saying. That's a common sense thing. But this is for a public safety device. And the other thing that some people might argue, if they're aware of the program, is we do not own the transponder. That is owned by the county, as far as I'm aware. We did not purchase the device.
Sure.
From my understanding from people in the past at sheriff's departments, the program is run on charitable donations.
Okay.
There's not a line item in anybody's budget for this.
Oh.
This is all charitable donations.
Sure.
So the ownership aspect could also be an issue, but if somebody wants to change the battery at home, have them go through a 1-hour training. People like me, I don't think would have any issue with that. Sit through a 1-hour training with your local sheriff's department. As I said, I volunteered to actually do this as a public service to the sheriff's department as a secondary contact.
And has that gotten any traction?
Oh, no. I mean, I said it, they probably just took it half in jest, just because it seems like, and I could be wrong, but it seems like they have a single point of contact. Which, let's be honest, you and I both work in IT. Single point of contact sucks.
Single point of failure.
Yes. And since we have been with our current sheriff's department, our original individual, who was great, we had him for a long time, up until maybe 3-4 months ago. I'm not sure exactly when. Retired. Then we got the sheriff's deputy, which he's still helping, I guess, part-time. But he's retired, so you can't expect him to give up all his retirement. So got passed on to another individual that, as I said, moved to another department, more local law enforcement department. So she's not involved in Project Lifesaver anymore.
Hmm.
I only met her once. She was wonderful. But because of politics, line items on budgets, etc., she moved on. I don't blame her. She's improving herself. That's awesome. Now we got this next person who, from my understanding, is an investigator. I haven't met her. My wife said she seems pretty good on the ball, but she only took over a couple weeks ago. So yes, she's probably getting up to speed on that extra responsibility over all her other responsibilities. But still, single point of contact, single point of failure. If I ran a hospital, I wouldn't only have one surgeon in my damn hospital. I don't need to tell anybody what kind of Pandora's box would get opened with something like that.
Indeed.
That hospital would be open for about 3 minutes before there was a lawsuit, and a big one at that.
All right, so I'm going to end by asking you if there's anything else you wanted to add about it, but it sounds like you've pretty well riffed with whatever has come along.
Yeah, we've had speed bumps with the whole program, but in general, I would say the program is a great program, and I would also recommend anybody that has an eligible child, family member, etc., look into it in your county. Call on a non-emergency line, your sheriff's department. Look into it, see if they have it, and if so, see if your family member is eligible, and if they are, look at getting it. It is a very good program. It's something good for people that need it. To be honest, and this is a little bit outside the current topic, but my father had Alzheimer's. It would have been great if it was a thing when he was still around. because there were a few times where he did wander off. So, yes, it's. I think overall it's a great program. I think like anything else, there is room for improvement. And as I said, if they could combine that with a GPS solution, they would negate, I think, probably just about all the negatives of each technology. The only thing that might be induced from a negative standpoint I could see is battery life.
Sure.
It would probably drop from 60 days down to 30 days or 20 days, and I could see that being administrative and logistical overhead.
Especially if they have problems finding time to change batteries already.
Yes, but and that may very well change as technology progresses. As we know, technology evolves at an alarming rate. So, but overall, I think it's a great program, and I hope it stays. And I think one of the reasons why it might not stay is because it is funded by charitable donations.
Okay.
Which, let's be honest, like, that's not something you want under charitable donations.
All right. DOA, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
As usual, we'll end this week's show with the fail of the week. This week's award goes to the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA. In the field of aviation, there are messages made available to pilots called Notices to Air Missions. Some may also know these by their older name, Notices to Airmen, but either way, they are usually referred to in short as NOTAMs. NOTAMs contains information about things like hazards, closed runways, VIP flights, technical issues, or a whole host of other things that might be useful to know when flying. Think of it like the morning traffic report, only far more important. In the current technological age, NOTAMs are made available, go figure, using a website. You know what websites do sometimes? Yeah, they go down. Sometimes web infrastructure's pretty good, and sometimes it's held together by duct gum, baling tape, and bubble twine. So in the case of the FAA website that hosts the NOTAMs, it seems to be the latter. And one of those pieces of bubble twine snapped when a database file went missing after a scheduled maintenance task went wrong. This kind of goes into the category of things that shouldn't ever happen. Database files should be updated, of course, but any creation, deletion, alteration, etc., that should be done by the database engine itself. And the result was a corrupted database. Now, in many cases, such a corrupted database wouldn't be any big deal, but this system is so critically important to air travel that all aircraft were grounded from 4 o'clock until 9 o'clock Eastern Time that morning. All told, about 7,300 flights were delayed, and another 1,100 were canceled altogether. Little Brother is recorded, produced, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fongaboo and the crowd at Helix for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 group. Special thanks to DOA, Fongaboo, Snackness, Asriel, and Brute Trash Can for story leads. And to DOA for appearing on this week's episode. Our headline music is Adrenochrome by Super Action 80. Our Who Got Punt music is Analog Summer 3 by Asarhad. Our Fail of the Week music is Space Reggae by Zap. Our opening theme music and bumper is Around Chaos by Heatseeker, and our closing theme is Space Debris by Captain Image. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or want to join the conversation, please drop me an email at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com or post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. Join us next week when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Stay safe and be well. Approximately 8.66 million US dollars must be built with gigabit. Let's just start the whole paragraph again. This kind of thing goes into the category of things that shouldn't ever happen. Database files should be updated, of course. Wait, hold on. Something is, and that.